Hi there, you've made another good choice of RN podcasts. Why not also come over to the Religion and Ethics Report? We discuss the intersection of religion and politics, international affairs, war and peace. Find us at the RN website.
Questions.
Analysis.
Conversation.
Debate.
Answers. RN.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you are so very welcome to Books and Arts Daily on RN on the first day of the new financial year. And welcome to a week during which we have a fair bit to say about sexuality, gender, erotica, and breaking the rules. On Wednesday, the transgressive delights of cabaret with lots of performance. And on Friday, I'll have a whole show devoted to Michelangelo's statue of David. And we start the week with stories of pain, both sexual and psychological. Bergman's classic film, Persona, reinvented for the stage in a very explicit performance. Nikki Gemmel with her novel about submissive sex. And a theme which starts the program with the story of O. So not a program for children today. Welcome aboard.
Mrs. O, will you tell us where the naughty children go? Will you show how the sky turned white and everybody froze? Heaven knows how they got into the fireplace, but everybody's saying grace and trying to keep a happy face.
Mrs. O. Today, erotic novels are an accepted part of literary landscape. More and more people are writing them and reading them and turning them into book club fodder. But there was a time, somewhere before Fifty Shades of Grey, when erotic novels were very much taboo, especially the extreme ones like Pauline Rigg's 1954 novel, The Story of O. The book is about the sexual escapades of a beautiful fashion photographer whose name is O. Well, she's known as O. Now, Rabble Theatre Group are putting on The Story of O. They're putting it on stage, and it's part of the Melbourne Theatre Company's Neon Festival, which is a festival of independent theatre. It comes at a time when Melbourne Theatre is seeing three plays which dislocate our ideas about gender, about sexuality, doing this in different ways. There's The Story of O, there's Persona, and The Lord of the Flies. The creators of this show, The Story of O, are Kate Evans and Emma Valenti. They join me now, and we'll meet the director of Persona in a moment. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Nice to have you here. So the two of you conceived this show. I mean, why did you want to put this story on the stage? I mean, it's a story about the sexual subordination of a woman.
Yes, most people ask me that first off. I think I was looking for a text that really challenged my feminist ideals and really challenged me personally and made me uncomfortable. And I read Story of O when I was about 20, and I was sort of taken by the idea of an alternate sexuality and an alternate female sexuality. And it's been playing in my mind, mine and Kate's mind, ever since. And then I felt like I was finally ready to give it a go, putting it on stage. And I think the idea that female fantasy and female sexuality has limits is interesting to me, that socially it has limits and we're not allowed outside of those limits. And I wanted to look at the taboo nature of a female who wanted to be a sub and wanted to give all of herself over.
So, Kate, I think I said you were Kate Evans. It's Kate Davis.
Kate Davis, Emma Valenti.
Kate Davis, Emma Valenti. Emma Valenti is the director. Kate Davis is the designer. We're talking to Emma Valenti at the moment. Emma, does that mean that you're putting your feminism on hold? Is that what you just said to me, essentially?
No. I don't believe I am. I believe that I'm pushing it to a point where I'm uncomfortable in terms of what's allowed, not in reality, but in a fantasy. Mm. And what the difference is between imagining something or reading a book and getting turned on, and the kind of grim reality of that. And we really look at those two things.
So we're talking at a level of generality here. We'd better explore what this play is about. Kate Davis, you're the designer of the show, The Story of O. Just tell us what's involved in telling the story. What is the story, broadly?
What is the story? Well, it is about a woman that is basically given an offer to consent to going into another world. And so what we do is we watch her go, well, in the book, she goes to a chateau and she experiences all these sexual moments with men and stuff like that. And it's basically, she consents to this, but what we see is
Moments is a soft word to use.
Yes,
I mean, these
is.
Are encounters of a very violent kind in which she's the submissive party. Yes,
yes, that's true. But in this, we kind of watch her fantasy or her wants kind of uncover in on stage in our version. And I like to see it as it's kind of like they're awakening in her. And we watch her kind of go on this journey to annihilation where she basically gives up everything and just wants to be nothing. And we watch that and witness that in our production. Or that's how we're taking it anyway.
And is your view, the two of you, that we go on this journey because this takes us into a dark side of human nature that our ideology can't deal with? Or is in the end, do we want to judge this and say, actually, there's something disturbing or unsatisfactory about the fact that such things happen?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognise that this does exist in women and in men, in all of our sexuality. So for me, it's really about presenting that to the public and saying this world does exist, and how do we feel about that? And really allowing the audience to question how they feel about it. We're merely presenting it.
And I think that there is a hole, I guess, or a void in all of us that makes us want or imagine certain things, and that might be connected to sexuality, and it might be connected to religion, or it might be connected to consumerism. And I think that there is a way for people to connect with what seems like very foreign and very dark subject matter to a more general sense of the feeling of something missing.
So what are we actually seeing on the stage, Emma?
Well,
I mean, we come in, we sit down, what do we see before us?
We have ignored the aesthetic of the book, which is very French and very lush, and we've actually set it in a more fantastical world. So you will see carousel horses on stage. We've set it in a kind of carnival fairground aesthetic, which to me amplifies the idea of fantasy, particularly of a kind of female aesthetic fantasy. And things are very funny for a while. We give a lecture on the kind of semiotics of pornography and some examples of what language can do to the idea of the erotic and what the reality of that is. And then we see some very graphic scenes, and one is an orgy scene where I was having sex with a lot of different men at the same time. And then we see a whipping scene, which people have found quite confronting, and it's quite violent. And then the production sort of moves away from that into another zone, a kind of comment on what people have just seen.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN with Michael Cathcart, and we're spending the day looking at some very transgressive representations of sexuality, performances of sexuality, and at the moment we're talking about The Story of O, which is a stage production now on in Melbourne, and with me is Emma Valenti, she's the director, and also Kate Evans, who's designed the show. How have audiences been taking this? I mean, let's go to the negative side. Are people walking out?
In our first preview, we had a lot of walkouts, but that hasn't happened since.
Right. And were they walking out because the first preview was a shambles, or were they walking out because it was just
the first
too...
preview was great.
Right. I think that because it was a preview, people perhaps didn't know what they were coming to see, and I think perhaps people were surprised or shocked, and I think that if you don't want to sit through the show, then you should walk out. I'm very happy for that.
And when people walk out, do you think, great, we've hit a nerve? Do you think...
I don't think great, and I'm not being, I don't want to shock people into anger, or I don't want people to have an experience that they don't want to have. But I think it's the nature of the piece that it will divide audiences. There are some people who absolutely hate it with a passion, and then there are some people who really love it just as passionately.
They do. I've been looking at Twitter on this, and the arts journalist Fiona Gruber, who we have on this show from time to time, has tweeted this: the story of O, one hell of a night at the theatre, extraordinary, bold, a neon triumph. Neon is the name of the series, which has been put on by the Melbourne Theatre Company. Bruce Ives says the story of O by Rabble Theatre was sublime, disturbing and amazing in equal measure. And Declan Green, who is a Melbourne theatre maker, says Rabble's story of O is the bravest, most incisive and most brutal piece of work I've seen in a long time. So at least your friends like it. It suddenly occurred to me, you probably know all those things. Yeah, let's open this discussion up. I'm talking to Kate Davis and Emma Valenti, who are the creators of The Story of O, which is part of the Melbourne Theatre Company's Neon Festival for Independent Theatre. And they're staying with me as we talk about a second theatre production, which also takes audiences into the zone of sex, suffering and transgression. It's a stage adaptation of Ingmar Bergman's 1966 film Persona. It's a classic film, this. And the scenario is deceptively simple. Elizabeth is a well-known actress who falls silent after giving a performance of the play Electra. So she's taken to a house by the sea to recover, where she's looked after by Alma, who's a young nurse who just keeps talking. And as she talks, we discover a very disturbing story. The play has received rave reviews in its premiere season. This was last year at Theatreworks in Melbourne. And it's returned to the stage at the Malthouse, which is also having a season of exciting works from outside the company, and that season is called what? What's it called?
It's called Helium.
Helium, that's right, the Helium. That's the voice of the exciting young director, Adina Jacobs, and she's the artistic director of Fraught Outfit and was recently appointed resident director of Sydney's Belvoir Theatre. That was a lot of talk I had to do to get to you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to our discussion. So let's find out what your motive was for doing your play. Why adapt Ingmar Bergman's very brooding and very long 1966 film?
I think the reasons for wanting to adapt a film like that are sort of complex. It could take us, you know, the entire hour to go through. I think it was a sort of a personal interest in notions of identity and how we can deal with sort of very complex identities on stage. I think that's sort of one thing. I guess probably on a more basic level, I saw the film years ago and it was the sort of thing that burnt into my mind.
So you love the film?
I love the film, yeah. I love the film and I'm kind of endlessly haunted by the film. Even coming back to the production a second time around, it feels like there's sort of an endlessness to the material or something.
So, on a mundane level, did you have to apply for rights to adapt the film?
Yeah, we did. We had to apply for rights to the Bergman Foundation and also to for the translation, the Swedish translation.
Now, I've seen your production and it's quite hard to know what's happening because there are two women on stage and then a man arrives. And one of them is the nurse and one of them is the actress. And their identities get muddled up. Well, they did in my mind anyway. So I ended up not quite knowing whose story was who. Is that because I wasn't paying attention? Is that what happens?
No, that's what happened. I mean, I think there's certainly one way to look at the film, and that's through the kind of the basic premise, which is that one woman is silent and one is speaking, and that it's a story about a nurse and an actress. But that's a kind of in a way, a sort of a thin ruse for this sort of very complex melding of identities, as you say. And I think what's really fascinating about the work is that at any one time, you don't know whose perspective you're watching the work from.
You know less and less as the story goes on. So you accumulate all this detail. Yeah. And in fact, in your production, you see, I mean, basically the three actors end up naked and you see the acting out of a very disturbing piece of of sex. So she has sex. One of them, I guess it's the nurse, has sex with a man in a kind of casual, incidental way that leads to a series of events that has traumatised, presumably, the nurse. And it's very confronting because you're sitting in the theatre and the three actors suddenly are naked in front of you and there's something pretty close to, you know, watching people having sex in the theatre.
Yeah.
But it's in an atmosphere that's very dark and unsettling. So it's not titillating. It's actually disturbing.
No, I think it's, I mean, for me, actually, what's much kind of more disturbing about Persona is the sort of psychic brutality of it. And it's sort of interesting hearing you guys talk about Story of O in that way, because I haven't quite made that link about this sort of desire for annihilation through the body that sort of exists in both of these works. And I think that the kind of internal disturbance of these characters is the thing that for me is the most shocking. The fact that we sort of see it manifested through these sort of desperate sex acts that do occur kind of three quarters of the way through the piece is something which I can, perhaps the audience can sort of take on in a more direct way. And sex also can sometimes be the kind of expression of our, you know, of our darkest desires. Yeah.
How are audiences taking your show?
In terms of this current season, I'm not sure yet. It's kind of, we're only sort of a few performances on, but certainly in terms of the last season, the response was quite positive. I was surprised because I feel like the material is very unsettling on many levels, sort of nudity aside, just sort of themes of you know, abandonment and motherhood and loneliness and all of these sort of things, and a very kind of wide audience liked it quite a lot, sort of, you know, ranging from someone who's in their 80s to, you know, sort of a 20-year-old theatre maker. And I found that sort of comforting but also sort of a bit alarming as well, actually.
I was in a hurry to leave. I had to go somewhere else when your show was over. So I left with a group of people who were leaving in a hurry. So I only heard from people who wanted to get out of the theatre as quickly as they could.
Yeah.
And they were not happy. I mean, two of the people used very strong language for what they were just furious about what they'd seen. And I walked to the tram stop with a woman who was just shell-shocked. And I wished I could go back into the theatre for the people who'd stayed around to find out how they had felt, because I didn't feel it was representative. But on the other hand, you have got a sector of your audience that's leaving the theatre pretty knocked around.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, that could be for a multitude of reasons. I think that something that Bergman achieves is sort of an extremity of emotion and a kind of a personal anguish that is kind of hard to bear. And I think I perceive that as something which is necessary for the stage, and it's something which can maybe be even transcendent and a release, certainly for myself as an artist and for an audience. But for some audience members, you know, it's not a kind of light night out at the theatre. And also, I guess structurally, he, you know, Bergman leaves a lot of ellipses, and it's not plot-driven in a way that we're used to.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're talking about two productions on in Melbourne at the moment. One is The Story of O, and with me are the director, Emma Valenti, and the designer, Kate Evans, and Adina Jacobs, who I'm just talking to right now about her production of Persona, a staging of the Bergman classic, the film that came out in 1966. Look, let's talk more widely now. We live in an age when pornography is freely available on the internet. People of any age can see sexual activity of every imaginable description. Did you have that proliferation of, well, I don't know what you call it, of pornography in your minds as you were trying to create a piece of, as you were creating a piece of entertainment? First, you, Emma.
Yeah, I found myself having to do some kind of uncomfortable research about this, because I think the difference between when I was a teenager, which is sort of 15, 20 years ago, and what teenagers sort of have to deal with now, I found very curious in the representation of women, and then the kind of what happens in terms of the way young women and young men start to view young women and an expectation that goes along with that. So it was very much in the forefront of my mind, and I've I guess taken the idea of excess and that we have so much access to sexual material and what that means for us, and put it in the show, and people will have their own opinions about whether that's furthering that problem or whether it's actually commenting on it.
They certainly will. Adina?
I didn't in terms of this production, because I guess, as I say, I think the kind of the representation of the naked body and also of the sexual body in Persona feels like a manifestation of something kind of emotional or psychic, purely. So I didn't in terms of this, but I certainly think that you can't avoid pornography in terms of art today and the kind of proliferation of images and the way that sort of, you know, images of a kind of diverse kind are made available to us at all the time. And I think the way that we now consume art is sort of very much tied into to the internet and to pornography.
Mm. Now, this idea of yours, Emma, that what you're exploring is some kind of desire for annihilation, I find that very confronting. I mean, part of me just screams out, no, I don't have a desire for annihilation. Believe me, I want to hang on. And I feel most people do. I don't meet people saying, gee, I'd really like to annihilate myself. I mean, what is that? What are you saying about human nature when you make that claim?
I don't think that everyone has a desire for annihilation. I think I feel personally that we there are certain drives that push us forward, and that we have different kinds of desires that can never be met. And I think that a lot of people pursue those wants and pursue those desires through a kind of sexual trajectory, but I don't think it's necessarily married to that.
And you think this is happening all around us, and we're not talking about it. So there is a kind of degree of transgressive sexual practice going on in the world, and yet we all pretend that life's a bit nicer than that. Or
yeah, and I don't think
polite.
It's just practice. I think it's also what happens in fantasy, and what's going on in the sort of recesses of people's minds, and what people find a turn on, and then suddenly find repulsive, and the kind of pull between those two things.
But maybe the notion of fantasy is that it's unsaid, it's not public. You know,
it's
something that occurs between two people who trust each other in a private space. And it doesn't belong in the public zone. Perhaps you're breaking the rules about the way fantasy should be allowed
to
live.
Perhaps I am, and perhaps that's why it's such an uncomfortable piece to watch in a group, because the live element of theatre is undeniable. You have to sit next to people that you don't know and watch things that are uncomfortable, and then that's very different to sitting in a familiar setting or by yourself or with your lover. And I think that's part of why the piece is difficult.
Yeah. Adina, you are also making public that which is private, that which is locked away. Can you talk more about that?
I mean, I think in terms of persona, the entire kind of event the event of persona, both in terms of the content and in terms of the viewing experience, is a lot about our kind of most desperate desire to be seen and known fully by another person, and having what is inside of us brought to the surface. And so I think, obviously, we've brought it from film to stage, and one of the kind of key questions in that has been about, as a live experience, when you're sitting, you know, in a group of people in the dark and watching this on stage, it's quite a different thing for somebody to be asking to be seen in front of a live audience as opposed to through the kind of mediated experience of film. And I find that kind of quite a confronting thing and an exciting thing.
Also, you're the director, Adina, and you've got these three actors who come into the room fully clothed, and at some stage you've got to persuade them to get their kit off, because that's your vision. Presumably you knew all along you wanted that to happen. How did you confront that? How did you make them so comfortable with or create a rehearsal environment where that was such a comfortable possibility for your performance?
Oh, I think it's just firstly working with the kind of actors who are excited and willing to, you know, work within extremity. And I would hope to say that I didn't persuade them to to do these kinds of things. You know, I guess you just hopefully sort of create a rehearsal.
They're saying, hey, come on, when do we get naked?
No, I mean, I think if you enter into a work like the story of O, like Persona, you have an expectation of, not necessarily of being naked, certainly, but that, you know, that there's a kind of, the boundaries are really wide.
So you must have faced this too, Emma and Kate, in your production of The Story of O. Creating an environment of trust for rehearsal must have been vital.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a dedicated ensemble who are used to working in our process. And certainly there was, like Adina was saying, there's an expectation once you're doing The Story of O that you're going to be asked to do things maybe outside of your comfort zone or that are... that feel extreme in nature. And we worked a lot in making the room very safe and the room very comfortable.
And ours wasn't necessarily about nudity, but actually just how to depict sex. And we had a lot of fun just with rolling pins.
A lot of humour.
Rolling pins and glad wrap and all kinds of odd objects to try and use different objects to make the sex act.
Yes, just a word, don't try this at home.
No.
This is Books and Arts on RN. Can we talk about the authorship of the story of O and the gender question in general, because you're all women creators here and the story of O is written by a woman. Did it strike you as a woman's book when you read it? I mean, it was written by a woman who kept her identity secret for the better part of her life. Does it strike you as a woman's view of the world, or is she mimicking a male erotics?
I think both. I think the book was written as a letter to her lover to try and keep him. So it certainly was originally written for a man by a woman. So it definitely plays into those kind of structures. But I think when you sort of dig a little deeper into it, you find a very female perspective within it, and you do get a kind of insight into O's desires, and it's definitely from her perspective. And the men in the book are almost deemed kind of faceless in a way, and it's really about one woman's pursuit. And I think that's in the end what won me over about the book, that it had an honesty in terms of its femaleness.
What about you, Adena? You've adapted a story that's told by a man, by a male director, yeah. Bergman. Did you feel there was a male point of view, or is that just not an issue?
I certainly thought about it. I mean, I think there's something very key in terms of persona, which is that a mother has neglected her young boy, and there is something about Bergman creating this film through the figure of this young boy and sort of looking at women through that lens, which is sort of which is also an erotic lens. So I sort of thought about all the sort of psychosexual things that were involved with that. I'm personally quite interested in kind of interrogating works made by men about women, and something about kind of repersonalizing that through a female gaze feels like something quite sort of interesting to me.
Well, this comes at a time when, well, it's a year ago now, but the theatre companies were being criticised for the underrepresentation of female directors and writers in their programs. Do you feel this is shifting? Is the fact that both of your plays have been programmed by major theatre companies a sign that there's been some shift, yeah. some determination to make a difference?
I think there's been certainly a shift in the past few years, and particularly at the moment, if you look around, you know, all the kind of productions that you've mentioned that are female-focused as well as female directors. I mean, I think that there just seems to be a general kind of expansion of the net at the moment. I feel like the fact that independent artists and works that are presumably quite radical are being invited into the main stage companies, I think kind of is a kind of a larger shift, and that includes female directors.
Do you feel that, Emma, briefly?
Yes, I do. I think that there's definitely been a shift over the last couple of years, and I think that that's the strength of female directors and writers and makers is really starting to show its
controlling
strength now.
Ego, I reckon, is important for directors, and there are certain male directors, I mean, who do seem to be living under the bright light of their own ego. So the whole work is about them. I wonder whether you've share that determination to be an auteur, or whether you have a critique of that. Just very briefly, you don't need to name names.
I don't know. I can only answer that question personally, I guess. I always come from a work from a personal point of view, and I always think that if I have an interest in this work, then someone else will as well. So I guess there's some kind of ego in that. But I also rely heavily on a collective of actors and creators, and I think that that makes a difference as well.
Well, we need to end there. Thank you so much to the three of you for coming in. It's been a very interesting conversation. Adena Jacobs is the artistic director of Fraught Outfit, and she's resident director at Sydney's Belvoir Street. Her show is Persona. It's on at the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne until the 14th of July. And Kate Davis and Emma Valenti are the creators of The Story of O. It's on stage until the 7th of July at the Lawler Theatre. It's part of the Melbourne Theatre Company's Neon Festival for Independent Theatre. Next up, we continue our dalliance on the Dark Side with the latest erotic novel from Nikki Gemmell.
This week on The Health Report, an utterly appalling statistic.
So Australia has been estimated to be the second worst performing country for diabetes-related amputations in the developing world.
Indeed, we're so bad that diabetes-related lower limb amputations have increased by 30% over the past 10 years. What are we getting so wrong that other developed countries are getting right? It's a diabetes special on The Health Report with me, Joel Werner, this afternoon at 5:30 here on RN.
And on RN, this is Books and Arts Daily with Michael Cathcart. Well, the story of O was actually written by Anne Declos, who took the pen name Pauline Rige to hide her identity. She didn't reveal herself as the author for about 40 years, which isn't what happened to Nikki Gemmell after she anonymously wrote her first erotic novel, The Bride Stripped Bare, 10 years ago. Just before its publication, Nikki was outed as the author, sending her under the covers. But the book, about a young wife and her secret sexual world, became an international publishing sensation, and so she got the strength and the confidence to keep writing. Her follow-up novel, With My Body, was the second in her Bride series, and now she's written the third book. It's called I Take You. Now, this is about a wealthy London housewife called Connie who's trapped in a marriage where there's not much love, but lots of submissive sex, with a controlling and cold husband, Cliff, and the strangers she introduces her to. Once we get past the opening erotic sex scenes, we're taken into the story of how Connie liberates herself to find a true home for both her heart and her body. And she finds that with the good-looking, down-to-earth gardener, Mel. Nikki Gemmell says that the sex in the novels is inspired by the story of O, but the story itself is a retelling of D.H. Lawrence's novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover. Nikki Gemmell explains the connection to Rhiannon Brown.
I've always loved the book, and I've always loved it for reasons that people don't really talk about, and that's the tenderness in it. The original title of D.H. Lawrence's novel was, in fact, Tenderness, and I think the whole book is about a pursuit of that most gentle and generous of words, and all that gets lost in all the kerfuffle of censorship and, you know, mad
and,
sex.
And infidelity. And I think I agree with you that the title of that novel does not help.
No, not at all, not at all. And so I've loved Lady Chatterley's Lover for years for very different reasons, and I've loved the political side of it too. It's a very strong book about social inequality in Britain in the 1920s, and I've come back from living in Britain. I came back 2 years ago. I'd been there for 15 years, and I raised three kids mainly in London's Notting Hill, which over that at that time I saw being converted from quite a raffish suburb, you know, very poor people in it, very artistic people, to bankerland. The bankers moved in after the film came out with Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts. It was kind of a cool, edgy place suddenly to live in. And over those 15 years, I saw a huge disparity in wealth. And one thing I was always intrigued about in this suburb, this kind of mad, glorious, crazy suburb of London, was its communal gardens. And for anyone who hasn't lived in London or doesn't know what they are, they're basically beautiful, verdant patches of green, sometimes acres of glorious green, the best of British gardening, with wild patches of woodland in them and that kind of thing. But they're locked. They're only available to the people who live around them. So in an enormously crowded city, parkland is not available for everyone. And I always thought that was extraordinary. And the British don't question it. It's just something that happens in that world. And so as I was living in this odd and wonderful place, I used to look at the bankers' wives and their Filipina nannies eyeing off the gardeners of these communal gardens and thinking, I could write a book about this, and I could go back to D.H. Lawrence, and I could update the whole thing. And then, you know, the London riots happened a couple of years ago, I think almost 2 years ago now, and that was in a time of great austerity for a lot of Britain. There was an incredible social anger from a lot of people about the haves and the have-nots. So this all came together in my book, I Take You. It just felt right for the moment.
So the essential difference between your novel and D.H. Lawrence's novel is the time, and the the role of women or the place of women in those times. In his time and for his character, Lady Chatterley, it would have been unthinkable to leave an unhappy marriage. But for your character, Connie, in our day and age, you can do that. So what did you kind of have to do to make her entrapment that much harder for her?
Well, I guess for my Connie, she was entrapped by excessive wealth and the pleasures that that life brings her, and whether she would actually ever have the courage to forego all of that. I'm intrigued about heroines who are sexually open, voracious, dare I say. You look at D.H. Lawrence and, you know, sexually hungry women several generations ahead of him in terms of Flaubert's Madame Bovary, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, Strindberg's Miss Julie, Tess of the D'Urbervilles. All these women, their male creators, the authors and the playwrights behind them, had to punish them somehow, had to kill them off. And that was usually by suicide. And then I'm fascinated that D.H. Lawrence comes along, creates a Connie with a really large, open sexual appetite when she finds a man finally who unlocks her sexuality. And he doesn't kill her off. He doesn't punish her. He liberates her. And so I was fascinated by that whole side of female sexuality and how far Lawrence had come. And then I thought, well, what can we do with a heroine in this day and age? Because someone like a Connie, she still needs liberating. But for me, I wanted to give her audacity as well, and I wanted to empower her with her choices. And so all my three books, I Take You is the conclusion of the Bride Strip Bear trilogy. There's Bride, there's With My Body, and now I Take You. They're all about women finding their voices in some way, their sexual voices, and with that kind of a psychological strength and courage to really be who they want to be. And I think you know, Edith Wharton, 100-odd years ago, described it as a curtain of niceness that befalls young women. And I think that still happens in that day.
Connie is the consummate yes girl.
She's a pleaser.
Yes, she's a pleaser. Yeah. But that doesn't make her like a sexually timid, because the opening chapters of this novel, Nikki, had me kind of very upset, to be honest.
Really?
I thought I was reading porn. And maybe I'm just not used to erotic literature, but I thought I was reading porn, and I thought it was exciting, but I thought, wow, has feminism come to this? Here is our main character. The way she gets her rocks off is by being the total sexual object of her domineering husband. She's just following his pleasures, and that's how she gets her pleasure, just by pleasing him. Mm-hmm. And maybe we need to tell the listener what happens between Connie and Cliff just a little bit, because otherwise what she finds later on with another man doesn't make as much sense.
Well, it's hard to explain it on Radio National.
No, it's not.
How far
we're all
can
grown
I go?
Ups here.
Well, I will say that there was another text that I was looking at. It wasn't only Lady Chatterley's Lover. It was Pauline Riage's Story of O. And I was, you know, that book is, what, 50 years old now. And I was looking back at it and thinking, there's something about that book that elicits a visceral response in the reader. And I'm fascinated by that. The books you kind of read with a churn in your belly and a flush on your face. And I thought, how can I evoke that in a reader? Because I think, you know, it's such a potent thing as a writer to be able to do that. And so I thought, I'm going to have some fun here. And I'm going to look at Little O, and what is it about her that makes her still feel fresh even today as a character? And we still read that book with a flush on our face and kind of can't put it down. So let me just say, it's an O-esque situation that Connie, my modern-day Lady Chatterley, finds herself in. But the story has to be one of empowerment in this day and age. And the story of our O is actually an incredibly sad book about a woman who completely gives in to her base desires and is totally ruled by a man, whereas I wanted a woman who climbs out of all of that, who says, hang on, what am I doing? Where is the love? Where is the spiritual connection? Where is the tenderness? Where is a more natural way? And for me, I'm interested in terms of the writing of sex, of how to freshen it, how to make it audacious in this post-Fifty Shades world where it feels like we've all done it all or thought it all or seen it all or what read it all or whatever. Where on earth can we go from here? Because for me, I don't want to repeat myself. I want to take risks. And this book is the riskiest book I have ever written. And
in terms of the sexual explicitness?
Yes. 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 You know, Bride has nothing on this one. And as I was writing it, I was thinking, oh, my God, can I really put my name to this? Can I really face the schoolgate queue? Can I really, you know, face my mates? All that kind of thing. But then I thought, risky, audacious writing is what I have to do to be relevant as a writer.
What gives you the courage to do that, Nikki?
I don't know.
You know, Virginia Woolf is such a beacon in this book.
Yes.
And I suspect in your own life as well. What does she have to tell you about courage or about what it is to live courageously and honestly?
She's such a beacon of truth and honesty. And when I read Virginia Woolf, it always has the ring of truth. And it's galvanizing. It does give me courage to be audacious and follow my heart as a writer and not try to censor myself, not try to be something I'm not, just to connect via honesty because it's incredibly potent. So Virginia Woolf, she heads up every chapter of this book, and of course she's never written about sex, but she says so much to us in terms of a woman's voice and a strong, audacious woman's voice that, once again, I still find relevant today.
Okay, so let's talk then about the man Connie wants to leave her husband
right.
for. So what does he represent? What does he unlock in her? I mean, it's a bit of a classic, isn't it? You know, wealthy middle-class woman falls for garden or pool boy. Like, it is a cliche.
Well, of course,
and
it's Desperate Housewives.
It's Desperate Housewives.
I'm
not saying it's not an attractive option. I think it's a cliche for a reason. But there's something earthy about him, and this is very much about a journey for her to bring the head and the body together in a relationship, isn't it? Which was also something that Lawrence was talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, there's an intellectual journey here too for Connie, and it is about finding a more earthy, natural, spiritual way. And I think once again in this day and age, in this post-Fifty Shades world, all that has relevance, because one thing we haven't been hearing about over the past year in all the discourse about going to hardware stores and buying chains and, you know, whatever else it is, you never hear about those qualities of tenderness or gentleness or some kind of earthy connection or a more natural way in terms of how our bodies look and how we go about this business of sex. And, you know, who knows what happens next in terms of the writing of it? I feel like every generation of women has to have a sex book that they've usually read, you know, no one else knows they're reading them and they slip them under the pillow and all that kind of thing. And I think that's 50 Shades. What is revolutionary about that book is that it sparked a whole way of reading for women that feels fresh and new in terms of we were all talking about it. You know, women that we didn't expect, talking with our mothers, our grandmothers, and the most buttoned up woman at the school gate, all the rest of it. We were discussing openly books like this. And I think that's wonderful. But it's like we have to go on from there in some way. And I wonder if there will be like a vast reining back in some way and a return to the natural, which is what I Take You explores. Whether I'm right with my instinct or not, who knows? But it's something that I very much wanted to talk about and something that Lawrence was very concerned with because he felt that 1920s England was being leached of all tenderness. And, you know, you just look at around us today and I often think it feels the same at the moment.
Yes, even if his setting or time was industrialisation, coal mining, that sort of brutal filthy, you know, turn into modernisation, and we're in another kind of brutal time. But it's
yes, we are. Well,
it may not be coal mines, but it's elsewhere.
Yes, it's about a world being encroached, and I think Lawrence felt that very strongly with his setting of Ragby Hall in England's north, which was kind of necklaced by kind of the ugly, grimy world of industrialisation, of coal mines, and there are a lot of very long descriptive passages in Lady Chatterley's Lover about Connie driving through and just looking at the sheer kind of dispiriting ugliness of it all. And being in somewhere like London's Notting Hill, you can feel the kind of social tensions of a world that is ring-fenced, that feels like it's being encroached upon. London is changing dramatically in terms of its demographic, its immigrant population, its white Brits are in the minority now. And I wanted to key in to all those feelings with I Take You, which has, for me, a very strong political angle of as well, of where modern Britain is at. And Mel, the modern-day gamekeeper who's the gardener of a communal garden, he's what they call in Britain a typical white van man, which means an uneducated white British male who feels disenfranchised, who feels like he's at the bottom of the rung now, and they've often got huge chips on their shoulders or whatever. But this is also a man who is incredibly tender and is an extraordinary lover. And that is how he connects with his Connie.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't feel that disenfranchised sense. I suppose you get that when... No, I suppose that's maybe a poor reading on my part, because I understand what you're saying, because at the end when they contemplate a life together, and if they were to do that, where they might do it, it's going to be probably in the new world.
Yes.
It's going to happen outside of the England you're talking about. Yeah, obviously you start that discourse about, for people like him, Mel, places like Australia will give him a new life.
Yes, and that angle of the book is taken directly from Lawrence, because at the end of Lady Chatterley's Lover, his Melors actually says to Connie, well, where should we go? Should we go to somewhere like South Africa or Australia? And as soon as I read that, when I reread the book for this book, I thought, he mentions Australia. But I must say, I think what you're perhaps talking about is a very Australian reading of the book, because I had my editor in London, you know, who's very much a Londoner. She actually wanted me to tone down Mel's chippiness and the huge chip on his shoulder about education and the social opportunities for children in England and state schools versus private schools and all that kind of thing, because she thought it was too much, but I didn't. So she had exactly the opposite reaction to do, because I did want to make it. I did want to make it a novel with a social conscience as well.
Oh, I think it is a novel with a social conscience. But for me, the essence of Mel's character was his stability, his rootedness. Mm. The bitterness about the social injustices wasn't at the fore of my reading, but it was more who he was as a character and what drew Connie to him, the reassuredness of his arm around her, again, the tenderness of his touch. This is a man who listens to her and wants to know about her, which is in complete contrast to her husband, Clifford, who is a banker, he's brash, he's controlling, he's not interested in Connie whatsoever, so no wonder she wants to get away from him.
Yes, and I think there's also a movement in England. I don't know if you saw the play Jerusalem, if it came out.
No, I didn't. What was that about?
No, it's by Jez Butterworth, and it's very strongly kind of an elegant look back to an England that is very earthed. These people who are connected naturally and spiritually to the earth of England, and how alluring that quality can be. And it's kind of a world that is fast disappearing in this new process of overcrowding and industrialization and all the rest of it. It's a play that celebrates that bucolic lost England. And so I wanted my Mel to be connected to all that world, and for a woman who is totally existing within an urban environment of, you know, Chanel shoes and Louboutins and all the rest of it, to find something so alluring with a man who's connected to the earth and who opens her eyes to the earth and reminds her in a way of her kith, her kin, you know, what she grew up with, which was a very different world, you know, away from the centre of London.
And her father, he's a lovely character in the novel. He's really salt of the earth, isn't he?
Yes, yes. I mean, he's a man who, and I've seen this in some older men, you can see it on their faces, they celebrate life. They've lived long, full, rich lives, you know, sexual lives. They love women, that kind of thing. They're men of great appetites, and they're not afraid to show that. And that's the kind of man that Connie's father is. So that he actually celebrates it when she finds, when he recognises that her daughter has been unlocked. Finally, sexually, that, you know, he's seen that she's with she's been trapped in a deadening marriage. What's so
funny?
That
did make me laugh that her father rejoiced in her sexual awakening. Like, I'm wondering how many dads actually do that with their daughters, that there's such a complicity and confidence between daughter and father that they can meet as adults and share the fact that they're both sexual beings. And isn't that great?
But Rhiannon, I think all parents, yes, I think all parents wish happiness for
yes.
their children.
Oh, sure.
And so he can recognise that his daughter, after years and years of an unhappy marriage, is happy. He can see it on her face. He can see the glow of it. He can see the glow of great sex and the firmness of that in her world. And he rejoices in that.
Yes.
I get too involved in my characters.
No, it's terrific. I love the confidence between hearing you talk now and 10 years ago. You sound so much more confident about not worrying about things, talking about things how they are, talking about your desires, just, you know, just putting it out there. But for a lot of women, it still is quite shameful. And where do you think sexual shame comes from? What is it operating within us that makes us ashamed?
I think it's the world around us. It's how we've been conditioned. It's going back to Edith Wharton's talking about that curtain of niceness that befell young women in her day and still does now. We're expected to be one thing. We're underneath, ragingly, roaringly, we might be something else, but we're not meant to articulate that other woman that we are underneath, that curtain of niceness. For me also, in terms of going back to the bride years, that was one huge flinch. I was just flinching from the book, from the world, from questions, from anyone associating me with the book.
You just wanted to hide?
Yeah, exactly. For several years afterwards. But I think it's also to do with your age. As you get older, you know, I was in my mid-30s during the Bride Strip Bear, and I thought I'd lost control of everything, my career, my literary career, most of all, that I just completely shot myself in the foot as a writer, and I didn't have control of the book, of how I wanted to be presented as a writer, of, you know, my family, my world around me. But I think as you get older, particularly for a woman, you kind of loosen and you lighten and you just think, oh, whatever, this is me. You know, everyone can just take it or leave it, and you embrace honesty and kind of you find out who you are and you just accept who you are. You know, no more trying to control and shape the image anymore. You just let go. So I think perhaps for me that's where the confidence comes from. And also, you know, I realised during Bride and that huge flinch that honesty connects and it's incredibly potent. And it was the readers coming back to me and saying, you know, thank you for articulating what I've never been able to say. Thank you for writing what I think that gave me the courage to go on and write a book now, like I Take You. Because I felt, you know, something like the story of O connected with me, even though I've never been through an experience like that. But you know, it inspires me to now connect with my own writing in some way.
Well, wasn't that a luminous conversation? Nikki Gemmell speaking with Rhiannon Brown, and Nikki's latest book is called I Take You. It's published by HarperCollins. And I'd love to know what you thought about today's program. If you jump online, you can have your say. Perhaps you've read that book. Perhaps you've seen the two plays that we've covered. I'd just love to know what you've got to say and whether you found the discussion stimulating or whether you haven't liked it at all. It's always good to hear what you've got to say. On our next, we're going to look at two more erotic novels. They'll be on the show. And also a stunning stage production of The Lord of the Flies, the classic tale of a group of English schoolboys who degenerate into savagery on a deserted island. There's a twist in this production. It's performed entirely by women, and it's very, very powerful indeed. Coming up after the news this evening, it's Big Ideas. Paul Barclay hosts a forum on the asylum seeker question with four heavy hitters in the debate. I'm Michael Cathcart. The news is next. This is RN.
She is very kind, very beautiful, very good.
Cate Blanchett and Isabelle Huppert are giving Jean Genet's furious masterpiece, The Maids, star treatment. On Weekend Arts, I'll be speaking with Andrew Upton on angry plays and sometimes angry audiences. You can download Weekend Arts with me, Sarah Kanoski, from the RN website.